Wintrust Business Lunch with Jason Turner, Chief Investment Strategist for Wintrust Wealth Management. Hi, Jason. How are you?
Doing well. How are you, John?
Pretty good. Talk to me a little bit about the consumer price numbers. The numbers that we thought were going to go up a little bit actually fell.
They sure did. So we thought we were going to see about a 0.3% increase month over month in consumer prices, more importantly, core consumer prices. The increase in total was a more modest 0.2%, and we're actually rounding up to get to that 0.2%. That's going to lead us to an annualized rate, if that month happens 12 times in a row, at or below the Fed's 2% target.
What do you make of that?
Well, I think we've been looking for a cooling in inflation for several months now. We started off the year hotter than expected. That pushed market expectations from 6 rate cuts back in January down to where we sit today, that let's call it 1.5 to 2 rate cuts with a coin flip in September coming up. The Fed has been looking for this evidence of a slowing and a persistent return to the 2% annual target for some time. So if we're able to string several more months together like we saw for May on the consumer price side, we'd likely have that evidence the Fed is looking for.
Is there any reason to believe that that will happen?
I think there's reason to believe that it'll happen. Where we're seeing trends in price targets, ignoring the noisy things like gasoline falling by 3.5% last month and food being effectively flat, ignoring those noisier, more volatile items, we're seeing key data within inflation in areas like services start to return to a more of a normalized pace. And as we see that, that creates a tailwind for inflation to continue to ease.
May's producer price index fell 0.2% from the prior month. Economists polled by Dow Jones expected an increase of 0.1%. Now, you and I were just talking about consumer prices. These are producer prices. Are we reading the same numbers?
Yeah, we're reading similar numbers, and generally those producer prices will eventually be felt by consumers. If a producer can produce goods for a lower price, they won't have higher prices to pass on to consumers, sure, like we've seen for the last 3 or 4 years.
Right.
So that's another good positive sign that when we get the Fed's preferred inflation measure at the end of the month that includes producer prices as a component, we're likely to see that more of that evidence that the Fed is looking for, that inflation is starting to slow.
Right, where I was wondering, okay, is this anomalous or is in fact this going to be a trend? If the producer price index is dropped, those haven't even filtered through to the consumer side yet, right?
Correct. Now, those have not filtered through largely to the consumer side, and we should see those filter through over the next couple of months.
Still, if they only have one rate change this year, maybe two, but didn't they? They weren't categorical in that. I thought they said there was only going to be one rate change.
They did adjust their summary economic projections at the meeting earlier this week, just wrapped up yesterday. And the summary economic projections used to say 3 cuts. It now says 1, but that 1 is an average. When there are 8 Fed participants sitting on 2 cuts this year, there's 4 sitting on 0, and there's 7 sitting on 1. So we'll average that out to 1. But I think, and Chairman Powell pointed to this in his remarks after the meeting, all 3 of those are within the realm of possibility for the Fed, depending on what the data tells them over the next several months.
So what will that tell the stock markets then, the indices, the Russell 2000 and so forth? If we're 0 or 1 rate cuts this year, how do you expect the markets to perform then?
I think if we're 1 rate cut this year, and that's the summary we took away from those economic projections, you saw in the reaction or lack of reaction really in the stock market, mm-hmm, yesterday. The market was, the S&P 500 was up above an all-time high, up above 5,400 for the first time. It still closed up there, even though it ticked down marginally after the Fed announcement. So I would not expect the Fed actually performing 1 rate cut this year to be very impactful from where markets are today. Let's call that priced in. If the Fed doesn't do anything this year, I don't see that being hugely impactful, but I think you may get a small market reaction depending on how well telegraphed that movement is.
Reaction which way?
I think markets are set up for rates to start coming down. So those areas that are rate sensitive likely see a little bit of backup in performance. those areas that need funding rates to come down to make the cost of capital more palatable to businesses. So the capital-intensive businesses.
Well, Jason, for the listeners who are just trying to retire or are retired and are hoping that their pensions or 401ks perform well this year, what would we hope for from the Fed then?
I think what we hope for from the Fed is to continue to communicate very well their likely direction well before they do it. We want volatility out of the markets this year for those folks, particularly that are close to retirement. Hopefully you have scaled back your equity market exposure, but exposure in the bond markets could still see whipsaw performance as we saw in 2022 in the bond market if the Fed doesn't communicate well and does something surprising.
Okay, I get that. And nobody likes volatility. But when I asked what for our retirement's sake would we hope for from the Fed, I thought you were going to give me a number, you know, zero cuts, one cut, two cut, 12 cuts.
I think where I'm sitting is one cut from the Fed. We'll call September a coin flip, and my projections would put us more likely at December for a cut, and I think that cut is more symbolic than anything. Again, already priced into the market,
right.
So if they go ahead and cut one time in December, that's what the market expects, and we finish out the year with maybe a post-election jump in a few sectors, but at levels only slightly above where we are today.
Jason Turner is a chief investment strategist at Wintrust Wealth Management, wintrustwealth.com. Nice to talk to you, Jason.
Good talking with you, John. Thank you.
Bree Fowler is a senior reporter at CNET. Bree, I'm a little confused about the $44.9 billion pay package for Elon Musk because it's his company. They're all his companies. So how is it that there's a disagreement over how much his company is going to pay him?
Well, right now, he only owns 13% of Tesla. He has lots of other investors and things like that. You know, the people own parts of that company. And it, like a lot of companies, it's run by a board. So you answer to the board, and the board sets the pay. But Elon also put a lot of people on that board.
Right. So maybe he's surprised at the results, but the number is still just bizarre. That is, how did they come up with a $44 billion pay package anyway? I mean, how does that number even in play?
It is based on stock. It's an all stock based compensation. So the amount of money you get is based on the value of the stock.
And that's not unusual. The company does well, then the executive gets paid more. You'd think there'd be some sort of ceiling on that. But are you simply saying that because of his stewardship, the company's done well, and therefore the math works out to 44.9. Is that it?
I mean, I think that's what he would argue. I mean, shareholders had sued before saying that this was excessive, and the only reason it was so high was because he was controlling the board, that he had put people there. And a judge agreed and threw out the pay package earlier this year, but now the board is voting whether to reinstate that pay package or not. And, you know, Elon definitely, you know, he has some sway.
Well, but I mean, the courts will allow that. I mean, if the board approves the package, then in fact, that will go through. There was a legal challenge.
Yeah, there. I mean, there have been some changes. And, you know, also they re-voted again, so that there was another chance to, I guess, for the board to make changes or just kind of let things go. But, you know, Musk is saying that if he doesn't get this, he might deliver on his threats to take things like the AI research that Tesla has and take it to his other companies, because he has other companies where he could use it, including a company that is just focused on AI and has gotten a nice chunk of investor interest and money.
I wonder what he would do with the money. I mean, presumably he would plow billions back into his other companies, right?
Yeah, I mean, it would be nice to see X or Twitter get some of that and then maybe start, you know, hiring people back again to do things like content moderation and cybersecurity and stuff like that. I mean, it definitely could be spent on lots of stuff. You know, he's got his rockets and things like that. R&D costs money, no matter what area of tech you're in.
Especially those. Let's talk about Netflix and the hot dog eating contest.
Yeah, Yeah, this was quite the news here in New York yesterday and the day before. Joey Chestnut is not going to be competing this year in the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest. There was a bit of a tiff over him signing a deal with a plant-based hot dog company, and Nathan's has thrown him out of the competition for this year, which happens every year on the 4th of July. And so Netflix decided to get in on the action and have their own hot dog eating competition for Labor Day. And it will be Joey Chestnut and his former rival Kobayashi, who had won it previous to him, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. The title of the matchup then for Labor Day, Chestnut versus Kobayashi, Unfinished Beef. I think that's a really funny title. That's really clever. But it also signals, doesn't it, that Netflix is getting more into live action or live performances. The Tom Brady roast was a hit. And where previously they would post, you know, you could watch movies and shows, and they're a big producer of shows, but they haven't been a big producer of live sports or live events. Now they kind of are.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. And that's kind of what makes this a tech story and a media story, is that they are getting in on live stuff. They're trying to draw eyeballs at a particular time. And Netflix has always been the kind of thing where, you know, you fell back on that when there really wasn't anything else on TV that was live, or, you know, hey, there's no hockey game tonight. Let's see what's on Netflix, catch up on Bridgerton, that kind of thing. They definitely are trying to change people's perceptions. You know, it goes back to when we used to get those DVDs in the mail, and then they started making their own shows, and everyone thought that was crazy. You know, how are they going to compete against Hollywood and the networks and things like that? And then they did.
The idea that I will have to have Netflix to watch NFL, say, or MLB, though, is that in my horizon?
Hey, quite possibly. They signed a deal with the WWE. I mean, I don't know if they really consider that to be a true sport, but, you know, that is a kind of a live entertainment as well.
Yeah, I think that's probably where a lot of these things are going to go, which will really hurt terrestrial television, won't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's less reason to have cable, to have, you know, satellite, or however you get your live TV, because more and more is just going to be coming via streaming.
Yeah, that's what it's starting to look like. Bree Fowler is a senior reporter at CNET, CNET.com. Okay, Bree, nice to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
As much as we love our electric cars, I think we have all come to the realization that the industry has not been able to keep up with the infrastructure demand that electric cars require, or that more ambitious drivers require. And whatever happened to the idea of driverless cars? Where are those these days? Dale Buss is a contributing editor of Chief Executive Magazine and the founder and executive director of the Flyover Coalition, where they talk about businesses and opportunities happening here in flyover land. Dale, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it.
What can you tell us about driverless cars? I know there was a story in the New York Times about what General Motors is trying to do and where they are on that. What can you tell us?
Well, it's all tied in together, right? And you mentioned kind of the consumer hesitation over electric cars and autonomous vehicles, and it really has a lot of implications for where the industry goes from here, especially for the Detroit 3. I mean, the latest headline is really interesting. It's actually today, I think, Automotive News had a story about a study, and this actually stunned me, that 40% of people who now own EVs say they would like to go back to an ICE car. In other words, internal combustion engine car powered by gasoline. That's incredible. I mean, if that is true to their actual sentiment and their purchasing behavior in the future, that's more than anything else I've heard, that's a real bad signal for the future of the EV. So it's the kind of thing that the automakers are trying to process as they decide where to invest their money, where not to invest their money. And something similar has happened with autonomous vehicles, where because of technology issues, because of the prominence of the electric vehicle revolution, automakers have kind of had to step back. And you mentioned GM. With their autonomous operation Cruise, they've had to step way back because there was an accident a while ago in San Francisco where an experimental cruise vehicle autonomously driven with an operator in it, dragged a pedestrian all over the place. California said you can't do that here anymore. So the whole industry is just kind of up in the air about it, and that has also has a lot to do with where they invest their money geographically and in what technologies they invest their money.
I don't know if we'll ever get to the point where Elon Musk is on this, but I know his thoughts about accidents with driverless cars is this. How many accidents do we have with drivered cars, you know, human beings operating
sure.
the vehicle? And he said, if you just do the math, even in the instances where it's not 100%, it will always be better than letting humans drive the cars. On some level, I understand that, but on some level, I don't want to be the victim of some machine's mistake, you know?
Right. I mean, it's going to take decades to get to the point where you can trust autonomous vehicles as much as you can trust your own eyes, right, and your own reflexes. And the problem with Musk is that he's been irresponsible over the years about touting the driverless technology that Tesla vehicles have way before it's actually ready for prime time. And that has kind of directly and negligently, and I'm not sure it's been proven in court, I mean, led to the death of several people who've kind of trusted and said, oh, Elon says it's great. You know, the next thing you know, they're decapitated by a truck. So that's a problem. I guess what I'm talking about in terms of resource allocation by the Detroit Three is, you know, how much do they invest in software? How much do they invest in driverless cars and even EVs versus their traditional operations? You'll note a while ago, Apple finally decided after investing $1 billion and trying to find partners all over the auto industry, they decide, hey, we're not going to get into the EV business. We're not going to get into the autonomous vehicle business. Too complicated, too much going on. We're just going to put our money into, you know, generative AI. So that's kind of where the auto business is. How much to invest in Silicon Valley? How much to invest in our traditional technologies? How much to invest in pushing EVs forward? How far out do we allow autonomous vehicle technology to go before we actually try and push it into the marketplace? There's just a lot of issues that the industry is dealing with and a lot of money at stake at a time when, yeah, auto sales are strong, but you see all the required capital investments coming up with a potential slowdown in the economy, and you can see why they're, you know, they're kind of caught on this.
Well, in my mind, I would separate driverless cars from EVs, and I kind of committed mentally to my next car would be maybe an electric plug-in hybrid, a plug-in hybrid that would also have a combustion engine. And it brings me back to your 40%. I wonder why that 40% of EV owners say they would not have bought that car. And if it's an infrastructure problem, there's not enough charging stations, that's not necessarily an indictment of the cars per se.
Exactly. And that's the biggest reason that was cited in this study is people are just not convinced that the infrastructure is there or is going to be there, or they've had second thoughts about even if the infrastructure is complete, you know, do I really want to sit around for half an hour when I'm on my way somewhere waiting for my car to charge, which is about as fast as it can go. And in terms of hybrids, you're absolutely right. The American people have embraced hybrids. That's where the market is going. So you've got a company like Toyota, well, actually they're singular in this. They embraced hybrids from the start 20 years ago with the Prius, and they've kind of continued on that trajectory saying, yeah, we'll build EVs, but we're going to focus on hybrids. You can get a hybrid Toyota in any model, and it's really helped them gain market share in the U.S. And it's just very practical, and right, you're going to help the environment when your car is operating electrically. You're going to get great mileage when it's on gasoline, but you don't have to worry about getting stuck somewhere.
Well, I'll let them figure out where to put their money, but if the criticism is electric vehicles are not here to stay. You know, look, people don't like their electric cars so much and all of these problems with them when it's super cold or super hot. But I think that you're kidding yourself if you don't think electric cars are the future of automobiles.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
They absolutely are here to stay. The thing is, the future just keeps getting pushed out and pushed out. I just interviewed the CEO of Toyota North America, Ted Ogawa, and he said their predictions are that, you know, in 10 years, you're going to have maybe 30% EVs. You're going to have 20 to 30% hybrids, you know, maybe 30% still gasoline-powered vehicles. So the EV revolution is well underway. It's just going to be pushed out a little bit, just like the autonomous vehicle revolution, which is going to be pushed out even further.
Well, this isn't why we asked you to join us today, but is there a an understood leader in that area? I'm speaking about EVs or hybrid EVs. Is it Toyota?
Oh, absolutely. Toyota is absolutely the leader. And like I said, they made the smart decision years ago to invest in hybrids. They are investing in EVs and producing them, but they also have recognized the importance of pushing hybrids. And now you find other automakers who have had hybrids but are kind of coming around to realize maybe this is what we need to push while we wait for EVs to get more adoption. For instance, Ford recently announced they're going to make a hybrid version available, I think, of every one of their vehicles, and they hadn't done that before. You know, meanwhile, they've got thousands of units of their Ford F-150 Lightning all-electric pickup truck, you know, sitting on dealers' lots.
Really?
So that kind of...
Because when those came out, you couldn't get one. There was a waiting list for those.
Oh, yeah. There were hand raisers. Oh, the problem is it's a problem of range. It's a problem of cost.
Yeah.
It's a problem of hype. And, I mean, for a while, that the plant that was producing them in Dearborn, Michigan was, you know, has been shut down. So it's a big balancing act that everybody's got to participate in. But you're right. The future is EVs. It's just a further future than maybe imagined even a year ago.
Yeah. Dale Buss is a contributing editor of Chief Executive Magazine, and he's the founder and executive director of the Flyover Coalition, where you read about stuff like this. Nice to talk to you today, Dale. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, John. Bye.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. More business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A new ranking puts Chicago near the top of the global list of startup ecosystems. Research Center Startup Blink, in its annual list, ranks Chicago at 15 on the global stage and number 6 in the U.S. The ranking says Chicago's startup ecosystem has a plethora of innovators and investors who are readily accessible. It says the city fosters an environment that nurtures creativity with a thriving and expanding tech community. Startup Blink's Global Startup Ecosystem Index has been published since 2017 and covers 1,000 cities across 100 countries. Chicago Inno says the ranking is further proof that Chicago has a strong ecosystem for startups, an important development at a time of challenging fundraising. Chicago research and data startup Tegas is being acquired by New York-based AlphaSense, a market intelligence and search platform. Tegas is one of 15 Chicago companies that made the Deloitte Technology Fast 500 last year. In 2021, it raised $90 million in a Series B funding round. Tegas's proprietary content includes more than 100,000 expert call transcripts, financial coverage of more than 4,000 public companies, and industry comps and analysis of more than 50 sectors. Tegas employs about 500 people around the world and also has offices in Vancouver, Canada, and Waterford, Ireland. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Business of food. Here's Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. And in case you missed the great news yesterday that was part of the Consumer Price Index report on inflation, the cost of food in May did not increase. Zero. And?
Really, grocery prices have been pretty flat over the past 4 months.
USDA economist Megan Schweitzer says food at the grocery store is only 1% higher than a year ago.
So this is the second time in the past 3 months that grocery prices have had no growth.
Yeah, 2 out of 3 ain't bad, right? Speaking of food, Father's Day is Sunday, and no doubt you'll be taking Dad out to brunch or cooking him breakfast in bed. Oh, wait, that's what we do on Mother's Day. I guess we buy Dad a tie. Do you know what real men do on Father's Day?
Real men cook.
Okay, and more from him after I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Real Men Cook is having its 35th annual event on Sunday, where about 50 men are going to be cooking up pretty much anything you can think of in a fundraiser for Real Men Charities. Here's one of the real men.
My name is Ryle Jackson. I'm president of Real Men Cook and the program manager for Real Men Charities.
It's a family thing.
Yeah, my parents started 35 years ago.
They started Real Men Cook to promote positive images of men in the community versus what was often seen in the media.
Real Men Cook, Real Men Love. We also read. It's a lot of stuff that real men do.
And
we know that men are some of the best cooks in the world, some of the best chefs in the world. And so you definitely enjoy the food when you come on out Sunday.
Rael says tickets are $25 for adults and $10 for kids. And he says there will be more food than you can eat for that price. And
some people may not be able to afford tickets to come to the event, but we want to give the kids, especially in the community, something to do. So they'll have a bouncy house, some hot dogs and hamburgers over in their area across the street.
It's all happening Sunday afternoon.
3 to 6 at the Quarry, which is 2423 East 75th Street. So it's right in South Shore on the Quarry Event Center. You can get tickets at realmancook.com.
Real Man Cook, the 35th anniversary. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Let's talk a little bit about this scenario. You've ordered something online. Ah, crap, I don't want that, or I ordered the wrong thing. But look, it hasn't shipped yet, so I know what I'll do. I'll just go back online and say, hey, don't send it. I don't want to buy it. But a lot of times, they won't let you do that. But then you could think, maybe I'll call my credit card company, and I'll say, hey, I want you to cancel this because it was fraudulent. Well, it wasn't really fraud, but I don't want it, and that'll fix it. That's actually called friendly fraud, if I'm reading the story correctly, written by Emily Stewart at businessinsider.com. Emily, welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks for having me.
You kind of fell into that scenario yourself, didn't you?
I did. I ordered something quite silly online and realized it hadn't shipped yet and regretted it and tried to cancel and the merchant said no. And I had a brief moment of saying, I bet I could go to my credit card company and say, oh, this is taking way too long. I don't want it. Let's do what we call a chargeback. Basically, you give me money and the merchant is out of luck.
So you did not do that in this case. I wonder, is that understood to be legal or unethical for you, the consumer, to do that?
I mean, I don't think it would necessarily be illegal if, you know, I said I thought it was going to arrive tomorrow and it's not. And also the credit card company could have told me no. I don't know if they would have. But what we are seeing is that more and more consumers are using, you know, disputes on their credit cards as sort of a customer service rating almost. So basically, let's say you buy something online or whatever, and for some reason you don't like it. Or let's say, you know, I don't know, it doesn't show up at your house, or you order a pair of shoes and they show up and they look, you know, nothing like you wanted. In an ideal world, you could reach out to the merchant and say, hey, and get in contact with them. But if you can't get in contact with them, there is another option to say, hey, I didn't like these shoes, I didn't like whatever service. And your mileage can really vary on whether that's super ethical. I think, you know, a good takeaway here is to at least reach out to the merchant first, because they're losing money. And sometimes they did send you something that at least for them was up to par.
Yeah, sure. I mean, buyer beware. But if it was a brick and mortar location, I would take it back with a receipt. Isn't there the same thing available to you online?
I mean, sometimes it isn't, and sometimes it isn't. And I think, you know, what we're talking about here is first-party fraud or friendly fraud, which is basically that a consumer disputes a charge that is actually legitimate. And I will note here, especially in the age of e-commerce, sometimes people just forget, right?
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Really easy.
100%.
Really easy to look at your credit
card. And really, how do you send something back if you bought it on Etsy or Amazon, for that matter? It's just, I know some of you have figured it out, but I know we have stuff in our house that we don't want, but we just haven't made the effort to find a way to get it out of the house. You know what I mean?
Right. And in that case, I mean, in a lot of cases, it's just, well, you know, that's kind of too bad for you. But some people are taking this route of saying, hey, maybe I dispute this with my credit card company and see what I can do. And it's not just in goods. It happens in services quite a bit, too. I talked to one business owner who runs a website in New Orleans taking, you know, reservations for different swamp tours and ghost tours. And he told me, you know, people will go on a swamp tour and after dispute the charge, saying they didn't feel like they saw enough alligators and they want their money back. And you know, maybe they'll go to him first, but sometimes they don't. They just reach out to the credit card company automatically. And then it's up to him to provide proof that, you know, yes, they did go on the tour, but how do you prove, you know, that there weren't sufficient alligators? That's tricky. And that's a lot of time and money that merchants spend on that.
You know, your article raises the question of, am I just being a jerk or do I have a legitimate claim here? That guy's being a jerk. I went on a morel mushroom hunt. We paid good money to do it. We did not find any morel mushrooms. It never occurred to me to go, hey, where's my mushrooms? It's called The Rise of Friendly Credit Card Fraud is Turning Customers into Jerks, and it's an interesting read. Once again, from Emily Stewart at businessinsider.com. Okay, Emily, we'll talk again. Thank you.
Thank you.